Hi, welcome back, everybody. Welcome to Ride On Radio. And I just want our guests today to introduce themselves and their new debut novel today. So do you mind introducing yourself in the studio today?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm Stephen Lang. I am the author of The Art of Falling Apart, which is a novel that just came out last month from Flexible Press, a local independent publisher.
Thank you so much for coming in today. Let's start with the title, The Art of Falling Apart. That's a big premise of the theme of this book. Do you mind elaborating a little bit about that?
Yeah, the title was one of the last things that I kind of thought of. Maybe, you know, I had a title that just was the working title for many years, which is Pigeonhole, a character in the novel.
Yep.
And it's really not about him, so I just needed something else. And I started kicking things around during my last round of submissions. Mm-hmm. And somehow in the back of my head, I had this idea that Tainted Love would be obviously an absolutely terrible title for a novel, in my opinion. But it was in the back of my head because it's kind of, that would make some sense at least.
Yeah.
And then somehow I just came up with this and I realized this is actually another Soft Cell album title.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from like the early 80s, of course. And it was not an album that I think I ever had. But it must just be one of those things that's just in the back of your head and it shows up later in life when you really need it.
Yeah.
The nice thing about titles is you can't copyright them. So you can call your book not advisable, but you could call it The Empire Strikes Back if you wanted to. And nobody can do anything about that. So it turned out to be a good title, and it's also not the only book of this title.
Yeah. We'll start with your writing process. Were you always a writer? Like, this is your debut novel, so like, was this something that you've always wanted to do, or just like a little bit of background about you?
Yeah, I would say always a writer, but didn't know that I was always a writer until maybe this moment. But mm-hmm. Thinking back, when I was a kid, I would do a lot of little tiny vignettes. I really liked Peanuts when I was a kid, mm-hmm. so I would draw and write mm-hmm. little comics. I think I wrote what I would call my first book in seventh grade, which was a children's book because it was an assignment in school. And I thought it went well. I even did little reviews on the back cover. I was just like writing the entire book, including like fake reviews. I had a review from like Mr. Rogers, let's say.
Oh, that's nice.
But anyway, so looking back, I would say yes. And at the time, I wouldn't have known that. But I would say more like about 20 years ago, to be honest, I somehow got it in my head that I would try to write a novel almost on a lark and failed spectacularly. And I still feel it, like, you know, nobody noticed it because I wasn't like, hey, I'm going to write a novel. And by the way, it's terrible. I couldn't even do it. I wrote about 40,000 words maybe.
Oh, wow.
And realized I don't have the capacity to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I just set it aside and realized I need to just learn how to write.
Mm-hmm.
I need to learn how to write a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And that is harder than you think. It sounds like super simple, but it's not.
Mm.
You know, you can get halfway into a story and very much just get stuck. So I took some writing classes, a couple in particular at the University of Minnesota, as I had already graduated, but I just went back and took these classes. Incredibly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Reading the other students' work, to be honest, is also incredibly helpful because they're usually struggling with the same thing. And when I sort of emerged from the second of these classes, I had what I consider to be a complete story and felt good about it. The weird thing was, and I can just tell a quick aside, I was trying to find a roommate at the time, and
mm-hmm.
I did live on the West Bank at the time, just down the street here, in a building that's since been knocked down, but I put an ad out and a few people showed up and this one guy showed up and we just seemed to like really hit it off. Like, why are we hitting it off? You know? And finally showing him around, the rent was really good, really cheap. And finally I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm an editor at Milkweed.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, it was like a gong went off and I was like, don't say anything. Don't tell him you're a writer. But I couldn't not, you know? So I told him, you know, and I'd been taking these classes. I just finished a story. And, of course, that deflated the whole situation.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to hear that if you're an editor, because you hear it probably every day.
Yeah.
So he said, yeah, okay, send me the story. I'll take a look at it. So I did. And literally, like, I have no idea how many months later, like a year,
mm-hmm.
I got an email from him and said, Steve, I really love the story. I think the characters are great.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should submit it to this Minnesota Fiction compilation that we're doing. And I was like, what do you mean submit it? You're the editor. Go ahead, put it in there. And then another forever finally he emailed me back and said it was most likely going to be included. And so that was my first published story. So it took me writing for the 40,000 failed words and a couple of pretty intense writing classes to write one story well. And then I kind of went from there. And it wasn't, you know, suddenly I could write everything that I tried. I kept writing more short stories, probably another 40 or 50,000 words worth of short stories. And then the pandemic occurred. And that was an opportunity for me to kind of go back to where I had been working before. And again, I took a couple of writing classes, really pretty long, intense workshops, a year-long workshop at a place called Story Studio in Chicago, and another workshop at a public space in New York, online, luckily, because of the pandemic. So those are the sort of the, that was sort of the path to get to getting the book into sort of submittable shape, or at least what I considered it to be. And then finally, I needed a better title, and I came up with that. So
I'm kind of curious about like this entire, like this is a long, lengthy kind of process. And what I really liked, what you kept mentioning, was like all the classworks, the workshops, and like other feedback, where it does feel like kind of a, almost a communal experience. Would you say that for the writing process? It's not a solitary kind of experience?
Certainly for me, it was, and it but was by necessity because I wasn't going to get anywhere on my own.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are people that can do that, and I just don't happen to be one of them. I also really enjoy reading the work of other people who are in the same situation that I'm in. And also, it's really quite easy, at least for me, to sort of figure out, so to speak, what's going on with their work, where they need to focus. And I hope they find it helpful. It can be emotionally difficult to receive feedback, of course.
Yeah.
But you're paying for the feedback and getting it. The one thing that surprised me is if you're taking a writing workshop, let's say there's 11 other people in it, you've essentially got 12, including the instructor, captive audience. They have to read your work, basically. So that was an experience as well. You know, you get to the point where you put a book out, no one has to read it. Like, everyone who had to read it has read it.
Yeah.
And now people might want to read it, and they might not. And that was a different experience for me.
So, like, from, like, people that were forced to read it, and then versus, let's say, the general audience, and just, like, kind of the reception of that, what was, like, the most shocking to you about the reception of audience? I know you had a Eat My Words telling and event there. How did that go?
That actually went great. Yeah. So I was really happy that that store was interested in hosting the event. And we had a good audience, sold a bunch of books and all that stuff. So I don't want to say that people were forced to go to that, and they certainly were not.
Yeah.
But I also, like, that was an sort of a slam dunk practically.
Yeah.
Like, a certain number of people are going to show up because I know them, and or they'll find out about it from the store and all that stuff. And I invited a particular author named Kevin Fenton, whose work I found at Eat My Words, who showed up, which was great. Great to meet him, and stuff like that. But the first sort of inkling of not everyone wants to read this is a review that I read on Goodreads from someone who is, I don't know if they're a professional reviewer. They certainly seem like a quasi-professional reviewer who kind of liked it, gave it a sort of a lukewarm thing, and critiqued the what essentially became the premise of her critique was that she didn't really respond to humor as a response to trauma in a positive way. And I sort of thought, well, then, you know, why did you review the book? Because that's basically what the whole book kind of is about.
Yeah.
How do you get through these traumatic experiences, in this case, a rather dramatic suicide in the aftermath of that, than experiencing the ghost of this person, possibly a hallucination of this person, but also with a lot of humor and sort of an intentional take on what if this actually happened? Like, how would I respond to it? It wouldn't be easy, but there might be something funny about it.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the book and characters, William specifically, because of his mother's death and his relationship with Sarah, the pressure. Do you mind just giving a slight overview about just the entire the premise of the book for our listeners here?
Yep. William Link is an artist who lives in Minneapolis. His mother died by suicide when he was quite young in a pretty dramatic fashion. And he, as his art career is about to take off, basically, after he had been in school for painting, he starts experiencing hallucinations of his mother, which he had experienced before, but not only hallucinations. Let's say it's a ghost.
Yeah.
She is beginning to help him with his artwork, and this has helped that he really needs. Mm-hmm. She had been a painter as well, and almost became a painter of some renown in her earlier life. And so he is kind of like, is he going to go absolutely nuts? Is he just going to be, hey, thank you, I need to take a nap? Or how is he going to deal with this? In the meantime, he has tumultuous relationships with basically everyone in his life, including his girlfriend, Sarah, and his crazy next-door neighbor, Pigeonhole. And he doesn't respond particularly well to any of these situations, which is totally fine. In my opinion, who would?
Yeah.
You know, if you're going through something like that, it's not like, oh, okay, check this box off. I see a ghost. That's my mother. That's a little bit uncommon. So that's the premise of the book, and things kind of devolve from there, let's say. But William gets it in his head that he needs to accomplish certain things, though, and does whatever he can to try to accomplish them as the book goes on.
Yeah, one of the things that kind of struck me out through the book is mental health is a big overture of the book as well, and how people respond to it. And it's always like the artist always having mental health issue, or like kind of, I don't want to say glamorized, but I do know in like the publicity sphere, it's like, oh, Vincent van Gogh was a tortured artist kind of thing. But it's not a very glamorous depiction. And I do like the humor that you took towards William's character and everything else. Do you ever have thoughts about that, really?
I do. Yeah. I mean, the over dramatization of the tortured artist, and they're also doing it with like scientists and business people too, like, oh, it's a tortured scientist, oh, a tortured business person. Of course, that's more interesting than a boring business person. but artists are interesting regardless. And I think that you don't need to glamorize what they're going through. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, non-artists are going through it too.
Yeah.
You know, you could work at a grocery store or be unemployed
and
have similar or the same mental health issues as someone who channels it into their creative work, let's say. But I don't, based on my personal experience, I don't consider it extremely helpful.
Yeah.
It is nice to be imaginative. I can at least say that much for it, but...
Yeah, let's kind of talk a little bit about like your own personal relationships too. Like when you were going through Whiting William, the other secondary characters as well. Did you ever take other inspiration from characters in your own life in towards your process of writing, or is it strictly like there's a clear boundary between what I write and then who's in my life?
No, there's there's no clear boundary. It's everything is blurred, which I think is fine.
Yeah.
You know, if you're writing a book about nature, you wouldn't want to blur the boundary between your experiences of nature and your book, let's say. But I also, there is no particular person who did this exact thing or lived this exact life, especially because I think things are pretty amped up in the book and it would be a little unusual to know a person like that. But I did, for example, live next door to... basically a musician similar to Pigeonhole. He was definitely an electric guitar player. I didn't get to know him at all.
Yeah.
but I heard a lot.
Yeah.
through the wall, and not just his guitar playing, but his arguments and phone calls and all this other kind of stuff. And gigging musicians, they'll show up at literally any time of day or night with all their stuff and all of these things going on all at the same time. So for sure, I took inspiration from him, but I never had a conversation with the guy.
Yeah.
You know, so I made all of that stuff up.
I was kind of thinking like, oh, you know, I live in an apartment right now, and it's just like some people are just coming in and out of odd hours because it's mostly a working class neighborhood. So it's just like, here you are at 5 a.m. and you're like, yeah, that makes sense. So I found that very relatable. One of the themes in the book that I really kind of want to touch on for a minute is using humor to kind of cope with trauma. And there's a kind of a theme of whatever it's comedians or I think of comedians personally, where they use humor to cope with like traumatic experiences or things like that, and some people really don't respond to that very well. Why do you think that is? Do they think like it's like, oh, traumatic experiences are have to be always in memoriam a very serious topic without any sort of ribbing?
Yeah, I mean, there's people that you're going to be sensitive to those kinds of situations anyway. So if something doesn't strike you as appropriate, you will have a reaction to it, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. And then there are different ways of doing it, too.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, there was a comedian from Minnesota, Louis Anderson, who definitely used his traumatic upbringing and experiences with his family in his humor, and people really appreciated it. But mm-hmm. there was also some critique, and there was some self-critique about it, too. I remember him talking about it later, just saying, I regret some of this.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop making jokes like this. This seemed funny to me at the time, and mm-hmm. it seemed funny to the audience at the time, but I don't think it's funny now. And so I'm not sure what experience I might have with that in the future. But I think some things are just funny.
Yeah.
And if I was, you know, someone else, I might not.
Yeah. I remember, I think, I don't know what class it was, but I was, or a class or a podcast, but I remember somebody telling me humor is the hardest thing to write. And then, like, the first to age the worst, because it is subjected to pretty much, like, the societal pulse at the time. Would you agree with that statement, or do you think writing humor just kind of comes naturally to you?
Well, I guess I would agree with the sort of the second half of that statement. Yeah. For sure, it comes naturally to me, which is, to be honest, is a problem. Because when I first started writing this, I just thought, well, if it's funny, it's good, right?
Yeah.
And that's not true. Mm-hmm. If it's funny, it's funny.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's good, mm-hmm. or that doesn't mean it belongs in here or it fits in here. If you're trying to actually tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to write around all of the humor until it had a place to live, so mm-hmm. to speak. Like, if there's going to be something funny, it needs a place to hang its hat.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just kind of floating around, and it's not grounded or anything like that. So, and then there's the sort of kill your darlings idea, and all of these jokes. If I thought they were funny, they become a little bit precious to me, which is also a problem. Mm. Like, if it doesn't serve another purpose besides being funny, it's got to go.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to learn that.
Okay. Let's kind of talk a little bit about other authors. Did you take, what kind of authors or other books other than like the students during a workshop, did you look at anybody in particular that stands out into mind?
Well, there's, if you're sort of saying like artists doing similar work to me, I would say just a little bit. I would say Don DeLillo had an impact on me, especially White Noise, which I read quite a while ago for the first time, just absolutely killed me. I'm like, how are you doing this? How are you making this both so incredibly strong and so funny?
Yeah.
And it's kind of not fair because it's sort of like saying, Muhammad Ali, how did you knock out that person?
Yeah.
Well, he was 6'4 and 225 pounds. That's part of it.
Yeah.
Well-trained, that's another part of it, and super talented.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say be influenced by Don DeLillo, but I don't know if I'm capable of being influenced by someone that's that good.
Yeah.
So I will just read anything that I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
And I can point out someone who's, I would say, not funny, which is Karl Ove Knausgård. I've been reading some of his work lately. And when I first saw one of the books, I was like, this is awesome because this is going to be torture. It's just going to be like super long, incredibly dry and boring. And it kind of was, but it was so good. I read his first book of the My Struggle series and then a book called The Third Realm and another one that's off the top of my head I can't remember. And it's kind of like, imagine getting on a 12-hour bus ride and sitting down next to someone and just thinking, oh, man. If they start talking, I'm in big trouble.
Yeah.
And then they do start talking, and then they turn out to be one of the most interesting people that you've ever encountered. That's basically how I feel about that writer. So I'm not sure. But lately I've read, I just read Ocean Vuong's new book.
Oh, how'd you like it?
The Emperor of Gladness. It was really good and very funny. Like, he is a funny person, and you wouldn't, at least I didn't realize that he was going to be, that there would be humorous situations in his work, at least based on Unearth, were briefly gorgeous, which is one of the most incredible pieces of artwork that I've ever reckoned with, I'll say. But just to say, you know, these kind of kids basically working in a fast food joint and all the weird experiences they have back there, especially with corporate America coming down on them and what they're trying to accomplish with the professional wrestling and all that stuff. So I highly recommend that book.
You mentioned to me in an email that you're working on a new novel called The Uptown Sinclair, set in 1950s South St. Paul. Do you mind kind of talking a little bit more about that, and like what specifically about writing this debut novel that gave you the experience to write something different?
Well, once I realized that a particular book is for particular people, mm-hmm. It kind of freed me a little bit just to think, what would I want to write?
Yeah.
What would I want to read? Because this book, I felt like I had to write it. Yeah. I don't know how else to put that. And then for some reason, that pun, the Uptown Sinclair, entered my head. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's going to be a Downtown Sinclair, two gas stations, and South St. Paul is a suburb that I'm pretty familiar with. I grew up in West St. Paul.
Okay.
But a lot of my family, extended family, grew up in South St. Paul. So I felt like I had at least a little bit of the background of their sort of working class upbringing there. Mm-hmm. And I would say the dysfunction of sort of mid-20th century society playing out down there with the stockyards mm-hmm. and the meatpacking plants and kind of everything that South St. Paul was at the time just popped into my head all at once, kind of.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about the title, like a pun being the title of a book. So I have an alternate title called The Bel Air. I'm not the best with titles for whatever reason. But anyway, this kid, he's like 17 years old and he's working at the Downtown Sinclair. He wants to save enough money to go to the University of Minnesota the next year, and he realizes he could make more money at the Uptown Sinclair. So he mm-hmm. bikes up there, encounters the owner, who is sort of a notorious type around town, driving a fancy car and all that stuff. For whatever reason, I don't want to say they hit it off, but they saw something in each other that they wanted. And he ended up getting a job offer right away, started working there the next day, and then he ends up finding out it's actually a front for a sort of a gambling and prostitution ring that's being run off of a riverboat down in South St. Paul area. So he just gets embroiled in the situation and he really desperately needs to get out of it. So,
yeah. What kind of like maybe the last question here, but do you have any advice for aspiring writers, whether stage they are, whether they're not like some 16-year-old kid in high school versus somebody who's just starting out in a retirement home? Do you have any like specific advice or...
Well, the only advice I can give is the things that I've experienced.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I would say is don't show up to the page thinking that this is easy or that you know what you're doing, because it's not.
Yeah.
I've seen these, speaking of boxing, these weird videos show up sometimes. Yeah. People walk into a boxing club and think that they're tough, or they show up and think that they can beat a professional female tennis player just because.
Yeah.
And then they get schooled, of course. And so just be prepared to be schooled, mm-hmm. but that's what it's about. You know, you're like, you really want to do something like that, take the time to learn, you know, from people who have something to offer and from people who are hoping to accomplish the same thing.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Lang, and your book, The Art of Falling Apart. Yes. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks very much. Chapter one. The wall that separated us began to vibrate with a familiar 60 hertz hum, and I knew what was coming next. A sound akin to automatic weapon fire, round after round, interspersed with terrifyingly high-pitched harmonic squeals. After that came a power chord progression, followed by several minor arpeggios, the same pattern repeatedly. Harry, better known by his ridiculous stage name, Pigeonhole, paused for a moment to let his guitar pickups feedback through the amplifier. I checked my phone, 5:44 a.m. For Pigeonhole, this time of morning was often the end of a long night out, playing guitar at some hellhole suburban rock club and then drinking himself to sleep, but not before waking up half the building with one of his sloppy, intoxicated, and totally unnecessary sound checks. I thought of Pigeonhole as not much more than a clown, a caricature of a failed musician, or at best a foil to my own artistic ambitions. I admit he made that a rather easy conclusion to draw. Sarah lay next to me, her arm curled up over her head, her armpit countersunk in shadow, her straight black hair spread across the pillowcase. True to form, she was still asleep. Sarah could always sleep, in noise or silence, in heat or cold, in dark or light, it didn't matter. She could sleep outside in the sun, in a moving car, in an airplane rocked by turbulence, or on a drafty wooden floor. To her, sleep was a game. For me, sleep was a test of will for so many reasons, and one of them was living next door to Pigeonhole. Nothing else. No drug, no drink, no promise from the gods could have eclipsed it. She knew that I occasionally lay awake for hours staring at her, wondering what she saw in me. Whatever it was more than I saw in myself. In fact, the only thing I saw in myself was a depressed and failing artist whose dead mother haunted him day and night. Whether she was an apparition or a hallucination didn't really matter. What mattered was the fact that she was ever there at all.